Welcome to Inquire, the Investor Relations podcast. In this podcast, we speak with senior IR professionals on their career experience to share knowledge and learnings around IR strategies. We also speak with portfolio managers and sell-side analysts to explore their view of investor relations and what constitutes best practice. In today's interview, I'm delighted to be joined by Nick Ashworth. Nick is Director of Investor Relations at National Grid PLC. National Grid is one of the largest investor-owned utility companies in the world. It has a primary listing on the LSE, where it is a constituent of the FTSE 100 index, and a secondary listing in the form of its ADRs on the New York Stock Exchange. Welcome to the podcast, Nick, and thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Clara. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's awesome to be here.
So let's start by talking about your career path that led into investor relations. Let's start if you can give us some background and your career history.
So I've been at National Grid now for about 4.5 years, always in the IR team. And then before that, I spent nearing 15 years, I guess, at Morgan Stanley. So I spent most of my career being a sell-side analyst. For a good chunk of that time, for 10 or 11 years, I was covering utilities across the UK and Europe. And so I knew National Grid really well before I joined it. Some of the people worked here, certainly the story and the financials. But then also for a good period of time, for 4 or 5 years, I also covered emerging markets, consumer and retail companies. So I used to spend a lot of time in Russia, in Turkey, Poland, South Africa. So that was very, very different. And so I sort of did utilities either side of that. Before Morgan Stanley, I did my CFA qualification at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and that's when I really understood or getting to understand the financial markets and where I wanted to be, and that sort of led me into Morgan Stanley, and then ultimately to where I am today at National Grid.
Tell me more about your move from the sell side to National Grid. You've covered kind of, obviously you were covering utility sector already, so and knew lots about National Grid. Is there anything you could say about your experience on the sell side that really shaped your approach to in-house investor relations? We're seeing lots of sell side moving into IR, which I think has been brilliant for our profession in terms of really raising the skill sets of investor relations, but keen to hear your thoughts and experiences.
So I've obviously spent many years dealing with IR from the other side. So I had a view of what it was before I joined. I mean, ultimately, I left Morgan Stanley. I'd been there 14, 15 years, and I loved being there. I loved the sell side. But equally, I wanted to see what was out there in the big wide world outside of Morgan Stanley. And so I left and actually quite quickly joined Grid. And I've been a bit surprised, actually, by how the IR role, or how I do the IR role, whether it's the same here as everywhere else, I don't know. I can only comment on what I do, but certainly there's interactions with the sell side, but it's actually a relatively small part of what I do. We obviously spend a lot of time thinking about our investors, investor targeting and traveling and going to see them, which is, I guess, similar to how you'd operate on the sell side. But there's also a lot of internal stakeholder relationship building, engagement, and everything from treasury and finance across all our business units, corporate affairs, and then how all that feeds into conversations you have with your exec team and thinking about results. And then also, obviously, you have to work with the board as well. So there's a lot of internal engagement, way more so than I thought there would be. And at Grid as well, we are a global company. We're half UK, half US. So there's travel to see investors in the US, but there's also a lot of our finance team and finance functions sit in the US as well. So there's quite a bit of back and forth between here and there as well, and thinking about the finance function, how we're growing and changing and evolving the finance function. So it is parts of it I knew very, very well from being an outsider, but it was a pretty steep learning curve when I came into the job.
Just picking up on the point, you mentioned sell-side engagement is a relatively small part of what you do, and I think that's consistent. I think the amount of time our professionals are spending with the sell-side is less than it was maybe 10 years ago. Having been on both sides of the table, I'm interested in your thoughts on how sell-side research has changed over the last 10 years.
This is a loaded question, isn't it? I sort of feel like I should say it was great a few years ago and I was doing it. It's now terrible. It's not true. I mean, the quality of the research is still really, really good. I feel a little bit for those on the sell side, because I think the ask of them and the ask of the sell side is changing and is evolving, and it's a lot harder and is a lot wider than it perhaps was 5 or 10 years ago. The stock coverage is wider, particularly in my sector as well. I was going to say, actually, the the makeup of some of the stocks and what they do is different, and therefore the breadth of knowledge is probably has to be wider. Although I don't know whether that's true, because sectors changed quite a lot over the last 10, 15, 20 years. But certainly the job is not getting any easier. I think with MiFID as well, and how you engage and interact with investors, it's another layer of complexity that perhaps wasn't there a few years ago. So I recognize that on the sell side, you have to juggle a lot. And again, different management teams will want different things from you. Some of them that you're almost asking you to be a consultant and get out your crystal ball and write research, which is looking out 10 years. Some of them obviously want you to do results and focus on the near term. So I think it's all very different depending on where the sell side, where you're doing sell side. But yeah, I still have great engagement with the analysts that cover us, not as many as there used to be.
I think that's an interesting perspective, because I agree. I think it is a really tough job. And I think the volume of stocks analysts are asked to cover makes it particularly tough. I think the consistent themes I've seen from conversations on this podcast is IR professionals see a decline in quality of coverage as a result of the volume of stocks being covered by many analysts. But on the flip side, when I speak to investors, they still heavily rely on the sell side, and perhaps more than I expected. So the importance of that role is very much still there, but it is a tough industry to be in. So turning now to your current role, did you make any changes to the IR function when you joined that you can share with us?
Well, the first thing I will say is I took over a fantastic team, and my predecessor did a brilliant job. So no, I was very, very lucky from that point of view. It had a lot of trust within the organization, with our management team, our CEO, CFO, but also how it works across, and I talked about some of the other business units that we work across, whether it's finance or corporate affairs, particularly when thinking about messaging across the BUs as well to our business units to get the information from them as we think about pulling together results and any other events that we do. So it was a really, really strong platform. I think the makeup of the team has perhaps changed a little bit, and the roles that people do have perhaps changed a little bit as we've evolved the team and changed some of the people within it. We've beefed up a little bit of, we have two people who sort of do roadshows, investor targeting events, because I came in 2019, so it was just before COVID, particularly in a post-COVID or through COVID, then post-COVID world, the way that we engage with investors has changed hugely. And so trying to find new innovative ways to do it is really, really important. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about that. And then I guess the other thing we introduced was something called our Grid Guide To series. So I would say we're really fortunate at Grid that we only report twice a year. We have half year and full year. We don't do quarterlies. But the flip side to that is it means there's quite a bit of time between our report, within our reporting cycles. And therefore, it gives us a little bit more freeway to go and create events and do things in different ways. And so ordinarily, we spend a lot of time with our CEO and CFO in front of investors. The whole point of Grid Guide To was actually to talk about topics which investors are really interested in, or which are topical or top of mind, and be able to get the experts from within the business to talk about it. So we do podcasts, we do videos, we do live events, we do trips. I mean, we've done all sorts of different things. And so it's a great way to tell stories in lots of different ways. So we create a lot of content. But it's also great for some of the junior members of the team to have ownership of something. They have an idea, they think something's really interesting, they go out, they will speak to the person who they want to use, think about how to develop the podcast, think about the suppliers we need to work with. And so it gives them something to go and work with as well. And ultimately, the reason we do this is just to try to keep a stable level of output all the way through the year. There's so much great stuff going on here. We should be using our time as productively as we can, I think.
I think that's really innovative. And you're obviously quite passionate about it from the way you're talking about it. So I'm always interested in different ways of bringing a story to life for investors. And I think that's a really interesting way of approaching it, as well as involving the training and development of your team at the same time. You've got quite a large team, so I think around 8 people. So I'm interested a little bit in how you coach and develop your team, what their backgrounds are, whether it's a rotational role within National Grid or they've come from externally, or combination of both. And also, when you are a larger IR team, how do you ensure the training and access to give meetings with the buy side and the sell side, for example?
So firstly, I would say I don't use the word large. I would say that we are efficient for the size of the organization, and I have this conversation with my CFO regularly. So everybody is a well-defined job and output to deliver. So we split it. We've got, as I said, a couple of people doing investor targeting roadshows and events. And I think that's the bit that really has changed over the last couple of years. We do a lot of our own roadshow targeting work. We will absolutely reach out and work with banks and other third parties. And depending on the jurisdiction, we will work with different people. But we obviously have a massive knowledge bank of our own. And so we use that. And we obviously have great relationships with particularly our largest investors, but hopefully a long tail of them as well, and some who aren't our investors. So we have a good handle on who's out there, where we need to go, and who we need to see. So we spend a lot of time thinking about that. And also then the events during the course of the year, where we want them, how we want to set them up. So Cara and Cameron do a great job in managing all of that. And then there are principally three of us who speak to our sell side and investors. And we can be interchangeable. So you'll hear the same message from all of us. And we spend a lot of time making sure that, as we do with our CEO and CFO, that we're all very practice averse in terms of what we want to say, so that there's that consistency. And then we have a couple of juniors on the team who tend to rotate through the business. And as I said, they will do all sorts, from helping with the results prep and the slides, and actually even potentially writing some of the scripts, to doing Grid Guide to events and doing their own pieces of work, which they can have ownership on. And it's a great way to see the business, meet different stakeholders, and work across lots of different parts of the business. So yeah, I think we're pretty well set up, and it keeps everybody busy.
Pushback on the team size there. I can't meet an IRO who thinks they've got a sufficiently well-resourced team for the growing expansion of our role into different areas in particular. One of the key challenges that we debate quite a lot at Equitory is how do you measure success in investor relations? And interested in whether you set objectives that you agree with your leadership team and the board, and how do you track progress against objectives, or how do you track and measure success in the role?
I think it's a great question, because it's also a really hard one to answer, because I think you're absolutely right. There aren't really obvious metrics. So there are certain things that we will do to benchmark ourselves against others. So number of CEO, CFO, IR meetings during the course of the year. I sort of like to see where the larger FTSEs are at and where we're at. I'm not to saying that we're tracking them, quite the opposite. We will do what we want to do, but it's always good to be able to know where we're at relative, and therefore have conversations around, when should we be doing more conferences, or should we be doing more roadshows, and what's that balance look like, and are we doing too much, or are we doing too little? So there is absolutely that. If I take a step back, the way we work it here is we basically have a 12-month rolling IR plan, and we will sit down. I mean, this is where it actually works quite well. We actually sit down with our CEO and CFO. I'll sit down with them in January and go through that 12-month plan. We have a March year end, so it doesn't quite fit in with our reporting calendar, but it works quite well actually, because it's sort of January, February, is you've got enough time ahead of full year to then start capturing some of this stuff. So within that, it will be all sorts from what's the key messages for the course of the year, what are the big themes that we want to hit and we want to talk to, how are we going to deliver those messages? So aside from results, what sort of events do we want to do? Where do we want to do them? What sort of medium? Who do we want to use? Investor targeting, roadshows, conferences, which ones are we going to? What worked well last year? What didn't work so well? What's changing this year? What's keeping the same? And then we can set calendars as well, because as I'm sure you know and the audience knows, trying to get time in people's calendars is never straightforward, particularly if it's a CEO or CFO of a large FTSE. So we like to be well organized and well planned. So we'll plan all this stuff a long time in advance. Not to say things don't change as we progress through the year, and you've got to be agile, but it is good to have a plan to work to. So ultimately, that's the plan that I have to deliver, the team has to deliver. And I guess the success or failure of that is around how my CEO and CFO believe that we've delivered it. I think it's as simple as that. They will have their own touch points and their own benchmark that they'll want to use. And then I guess output from the board feeds into that as well. So if the specifics from the board that they want to see during the course of the year, then we can work it into the plan as well.
That all makes perfect sense. And I love the fact you've got the January, February period ahead of all your reporting to actually kind of get sort of the goal set for the year ahead. I've once seen the inverse of this, where we've got a client where the CEO and CFO said, this is how much time we're each going to spend on IR. So how do you prioritize our time within that, which is not maybe the recommended way to go about things, but an interesting way of approaching it. And actually, when you map out how much time management really do have, engagement really does help focus the team and prioritize their engagement within that. Speaking of management teams, so how do you communicate with the board?
The board has its meetings on its cycle each year, and my team has to write papers for the board, particularly around results and any other specific events potentially that we're doing. So if there's some IR specific stuff, then there will be papers going to the board. We also do a regular sort of newsletter which goes to the board as well. It's just a 2-pager which we update each time they meet around the register, what's changed, key topics, key themes, some of the macro stuff which has happened, which may have relevance to us, and share price movements. I'll end up going to the board and talking about lots of different areas where IR sits. But we've also brought investors into the board over the last couple of years as well. We did a lunch and we had a session at the board last summer as well, where we had investors come in and talk about how they're seeing the market and how they see National Grid. So all sorts of different ways.
Really interesting point. You're the first person who've mentioned actually getting investors in person to present. And that's a really helpful insight, I think, to provide to the board, because it might not be exactly what they're expecting as well. So I think that could be really helpful. A lot of our listeners are relatively early stage in their IR career. Do you have any tips for how to start to engage with the board?
That's a good question. And do you know what? It was the one area, I guess, that I'd had little experience of before I joined Grid. I think I'd been to a board or two as my time as a sell-side analyst, where I'd been asked in to present views. But sort of the how you interact and what they want from you, I didn't really know. So it's been a bit of a sort of a learning process. I mean, ultimately what I would say is they are obviously all very experienced and all in different ways. They bring something different to the board, which is hugely valuable, because you want a board to have different perspectives and different experiences. And so when I speak to one of our NEDs, certainly I will spend a lot of time listening, because I want to hear what they have to say. They'll have seen and done a lot of what we're doing. So getting their feedback and their views on what we could do and how they've done it before, how they've seen things turn out, is incredibly valuable. So listening is always, I mean, whoever you speak to, listening to people and hearing what they're actually saying is hugely important. But the one thing I would say is, whilst they have lots of expertise in their areas, they are not the financial communications expert for this company or for your company. And so they want to hear what you have to say. So it really is a two-way dialogue. And we've got some really great NEDs, actually. I've had some really great conversations with them over the last few years. But it's that. It's a two-way. They really want to hear what I'm saying and what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing in the market. But likewise, I really want to hear what they think of that and some of the experiences they've had and how that can help me do my job better.
I think board meetings is a really interesting one, because I think you can only really understand them if you've had the opportunity to sit through all or part of a board meeting. And the thing that I think surprised me the first time I was just able to listen in on a board meeting was just the amount of information they have to cover in a very short space of time. And getting an understanding of that meant I really learned to scale back what was important and what wasn't. And the kind of information you give to your line manager, normally the CFO, is very different to actually what the board needs to know. And so kind of when we're coaching our team members and we're doing presentations to boards, the first thing we always do is scale back the detail. What's the big picture information? How do we distill that into a really succinct summary that's going to be helpful but interesting for them to engage with?
And actually, if I can just jump in there, because I think you're absolutely right. And it's been quite, if I just think about my interactions over the last 4 or 5 years here, the board has changed a little bit as well. So we've had a number of people who've left and new members come in. And therefore, the dynamic of the board has changed as well. I mean, we've got a new chair as well since I first started, and they have very different ways of leading meetings. And so I absolutely agree with you that you go to the board and they tend to want a higher level than you'll tend to delve into with colleagues around. It's not always true for every member. So actually, those relationships are super, super important, because you need to know where questions can come. But therefore, how the meetings evolve and the dynamics of the meetings will change depending on who's in them. So it took me a while to get used to them and get used to the participants. And yeah, with any type of group, it just takes a bit of a while to get your feet on the table and sort of understand how you can add value, I think.
It's a good point. One of the NEDs on a couple of my clients is Excelside. So they tend to ask very detailed questions about the engagement with the city. So you're right. Understanding the personalities and level of interest involved is key as well. So let's talk a little bit about the shape of your share register and your marketing plan for the year ahead. Do you have any specific targets or goals when it comes to the structure of your investor base?
My first answer is always a bit of a flippant one, which is I sort of don't care as long as I've got people wanting to buy my shares and I don't really care where they come from. I always feel that I should make it sound like I'm a bit more intelligent and structured and have thought through where I want my register to be and how it looks. But no, first and foremost, you have to tell a compelling story, which is engaging, which is of wide reach, because lots of investors out there do lots of different things. They have lots of competition for their time, and you need to cut through and get them to listen to what you're saying. So that's the first thing. I mean, regardless of where we go, we need to have a message which is compelling and resonates. So we spend a lot of time thinking about that. And actually the sector we're in at the moment is quite helpful for that, because there's a huge amount of exciting stuff going on which we can talk to. I would say that we're also quite fortunate because we're broadly 50-50 UK-US. And actually where we are in the US, we're really lucky with, because it's in the US Northeast. So our two main jurisdictions are New York and Massachusetts, so New York and Boston. When I think about going out and meeting investors, we spent a long time in London, obviously. Big market, really easy to go out and see investors here. And we spend quite a lot of time in the Northeast as well, because again, there's no pressure for me to have to fill up days back to back and just think about the 2 days we need to be there. We can do it as and when we're over there. We have offices in New York, we have offices in Boston. There are two major hubs in the US. So we can do it around sort of ordinary internal work as well. So it gives me a lot more flexibility, which is great. So we do spend a lot of time in those two markets. Nearly 40% of our registrars in the US. We spent a bit of time over the last year or two trying to grow the US part of the register. It's obviously the biggest, most liquid market out there. So we spend a lot of time on the East Coast. We spend time on the West Coast. We spend a good amount of time in Chicago and in Canada as well. Lots of infrastructure knowledge. We've also spent time as an IR team going around some of the sort of the tier two locations as well. So we do spend a lot of time focusing on the US. I think it's a really, really sensible place to go to try to find that incremental investment. We do bits and pieces in Europe. We don't spend a huge amount of time in Europe because the markets, my experience is that you can get two or three good meetings. It's hard to get four or five. And so it's there, you do have to go. And if you're taking a management team, you are taking an entire day out. So I really need to feel like it's a good use of time. And particularly in a world where you can do a lot of hybrid, all those investors come to London, do we need to spend as much time going to the continent? So we don't, we'll go to some of the big conferences, but we perhaps don't go doing our own roadshows there as much as we would have done before COVID. The other area we're spending a bit more time now is in Asia and Australia. So we've been down to Australia since COVID twice, so last year and the year before. And then we've actually done Asia roadshows at the same time. So I went down with our CEO to Australia, and then Angela went down with our CFO to Asia 18 months ago. And then last year, I took my CFO to Australia and Angela went with our CEO to Asia. So we've been spending a bit more time there. We've seen an increase in our register from those as well. Australia is, I mean, for an infrastructure company, it's a no-brainer. The level of knowledge, the meetings are fantastic, and you get a lot of them in a very short period of time. And actually, it's really quite efficient, particularly if you go on a weekend. You can get there on a Monday night. You can do two or three back-to-back days, and then you can be back in London on the Thursday or Friday lunchtime and back in the office. So it's really, really tiring. But I have to say, it's been a really great use of time. And we've met some great people and had really, really great meetings. So it's going to be something we're going to continue doing.
Interesting. You're the first person who talked about Australia, but it does make sense with your sector, I think. And whereabouts in Asia have you visited then? You mentioned the roadshow there.
Yeah, so I'm using Asia in its broadest term, but we've done a few different bits. Actually, we've done Singapore, we've done Japan. I think we did a joint one with our debt team actually last year as well. I think we went to Kuala Lumpur. And then we also do the Middle East as well. And we tend to do the Middle East either as we go to Australia or doing Asia.
And is that more sovereign wealth money or institutional, a mix?
It does tend to be a mix. I mean, absolutely sovereign wealth, but we will try and meet as many as we can with that.
Just on the US engagement piece, you've got an ADR listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Is there anything you can comment on the ADR program? Has that made it easier to grow the portion of your US share register or get access to US investors?
It's a good question. I don't know what the answer is, to be honest, because I don't know if it would make a difference if we didn't have it. It's certainly not unhelpful. It's not a huge part of our overall register, but it does give US investors a different way to access if they don't want to hold the ordinaries. So it's not unhelpful, but I don't know whether it would change enormously our program or our engagement if we didn't have it. But yeah, I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to have.
And do you have a preference for conferences alongside roadshows as well?
Going back actually to what I said earlier about we sort of do benchmark and look at ourselves relative to some of the other FTSE companies. I do think we probably do more roadshows and maybe a little bit less on the conference side. I think that partly that's due to the fact that we do a lot of these meetings in-house and we organize a lot of the roadshows ourselves. So it means that we are engaging with a lot of the people we want to engage with anyway. That said, conferences are good because you will tend to speak to people who you perhaps won't see on your roadshow. So we absolutely will do some of the major conferences during the course of the year, but we certainly don't over-index on conferences.
It's interesting, speaking to fund managers recently, it was completely binary on conferences. Some love them and some hate them. So I think you're right, you're not going to get access to the fullest range of investors that way. And feedback, how do you approach investors for feedback, or do you rely on corporate brokers?
No, so we're changing what we're doing, actually. So I think it's hugely important. I would like to think that we have a pretty good engagement with, well, actually both sell side and buy side, but if people wanted to give us a tough message, they would do it, as well as very positive ones as well, I would say. It's not all bad. So my serious point is I would hope that we'd get it anyway. That said, I think getting targeted feedback is really, really important. So we used to do it through our CRM platform. So we'd automatically just send a quick couple of questions and then a sort of a free text box to investors straight after the meeting, and they'd fill it in and we'd monitor that pretty much all the time. We'd get pretty high ratings and people were very happy. Very, very occasionally some would come back where they weren't happy and it's something for us to go away and think about. We're becoming a bit more targeted now in what we're doing. So we're starting to work with a company who they work to get more defined feedback over the course of time, and you can use that to look at how you're telling the story, what's resonating, what's not. And it's just a bit more in depth. And so I just think there's a huge amount of value in feedback, and there's lots of different ways you can get it. And so we're sort of trying to come up with ways where we can make it a lot more of a valuable tool to be able to help us craft the message and the story and the targeting and where we go. And yeah, but the whole piece, to be honest.
Can we talk a little bit about internal comms? How do you get involved with internal comms across such a large organization?
So there's a few different bits and pieces, I'd say. So as a company and as a sector, we are going through a generational change. The electricity networks, not just in the UK, but all over Europe, the US, the world, need to change for the way in which we are utilizing them. So whether it be more clean power coming on, whether it more electric vehicles, whether it ultimately be decarbonisation or of heating, the networks that we use and operate are changing, and changing very, very quickly. It's an incredibly exciting story. It's an incredibly exciting time. There's a hugely important clean energy, sustainable message to go along with that as well. Net zero cannot be reached in the UK or the US Northeast where we are without the grids changing and evolving and enabling that connection of clean power. So we've got a really, really important role to play. I feel like the biggest way we can make noise is to have the 30,000 people who work for National Grid going out there and being its biggest cheerleader. Do I sit here today and believe that everybody in our organization knows exactly what we're doing, how we're doing it, why we're doing it? No. And so we have a really important role to play as an IR team to help our internal comms to deliver that message. Because ultimately, the message is the same, whether it's going to investors, whether it's going to politicians, regulators, consumers, business, it all has to be the same message. So we spent a lot of time over the last 12, 24 months thinking about not only our external messaging, but also our internal messaging so that that can magnify our external messaging. And my team do a lot of town halls. We've really stepped that up over the last 12 months across each of our business units, particularly around results, but not just around results. If we do events as well, we try to work with the leadership teams of those business units. And when they do big town halls and they speak to their business units, we'll get involved and we'll tell the message. And that's been incredibly popular, incredibly powerful. We've had great feedback from that as well. And then, as you said, the grid guide to the series of events that we've been doing, that enables us to go into the businesses, into the functions, and talk to people who perhaps we wouldn't ordinarily talk to, so that they can get their message out to not only my stakeholders, but then that will then get used internally as well by the business to go to our people and then out externally that way as well. So it's that feedback loop. It's just getting a much, much better, stronger feedback loop so that everybody's telling the same story. And ultimately, particularly in a corporate which is having to grow, and we're investing more, and we're having to build up our capabilities, we want everybody to understand the story we're telling and be as excited as we are about telling it, because it's also another way to get new talent in and new people in and the best people to deliver the infrastructure that we need over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So yeah, it all comes down to having a really, really powerful story and getting that out in as many different ways as possible.
Let's come on to talk about trends we're seeing in investor relations, starting with equity market backdrop. So 2023 was certainly a challenging year, particularly in the UK. We saw substantial fund outflows, which often impacts companies' ability to attract or retain investors. Do you have any thoughts on this? And particularly interested in any feedback perhaps you're getting with the split of your register broadly, sort of US and UK as well, any sort of regional differences in US investors' approach to UK equities, for example, anything would be interesting to hear your perspectives on.
So, I mean, it constantly evolves. So the macro is always changing. The political backdrop's always changing. The regulatory backdrop's always changing. So the first thing I would say is whatever's going on, we just need to make sure that we are prepared for the questions. And ultimately, we have good answers, but actually we have good working business practices so that we can deliver the right outputs regardless of whatever's going on in the wider world. And ultimately, that's what investors want from us. They want us to be a safe haven. We're a defensive company. We're a regulated utility. And they should know that investing in us, yes, there's going to be externalities which move around, but hopefully it shouldn't be enough to knock us off course. And that's what they want to hear from us. They want to hear that we can continue to deliver. In terms of specifics, though, I mean, I think things have changed a little bit over the last few years. If I go back to when I first started, there was a general election in the UK back in 2019, and there was the concern question around a Labour victory and what that would mean around National Grid and the energy sector, and would National Grid amongst others be a target for nationalisation? So that's certainly weighed down on people's views, particularly in the US and outside of the UK, because you tend to be one step removed. And so I always think that if there's something going on, particularly locally, investors who are a geography or more away, it just gives them a reason not to want to get involved. So having stability of macro, having stability of politics and regulation, I think is incredibly helpful. Again, we're in another political year this year. Hopefully, regardless of the outcome in the UK, it shouldn't really change our progress. Both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party are publicly very positive around net zero and energy transition. So I think there is less investor concern or questions around UK politics. In the US, again, we've got Trump versus Biden, what does that mean? But I think there's also the realization that regardless of what happens at the federal level, a lot of what we do is driven by what goes on at the state level. And we certainly saw that, we've seen that through this administration, we saw that through the last Trump administration as well. So we get a lot more questions around what's going on at the state level, as opposed to the big picture, what's going on at the federal level. But absolutely, these are all the types of questions that feed in. We're seeing a change in the macro environment. How does that change our financing? We have a big CapEx program to deliver. We're very capital intensive. So what does that mean for cost of funding? How does the regulatory framework work with that? Inflation's obviously been moving around a lot as well. So again, how protected are we against that? What mechanisms do we have in place? Where are we exposed? As lots of other companies do, we have to be able to explain positively why all of these things do change and we're still a really great place to be, and why investors should want to partner with us.
Particularly impressed by the level of knowledge required to talk by regulation on a state-by-state basis. Some other FTSE 100 IR teams have talked about they've got the internal capability to request AI tools and technologies that might support in making the IR function more efficient. Is that something, you're smiling, so maybe not, but is that something you have access to at National Grid, or any thoughts on the development of AI and how it might help our profession?
So look, it is evolving. I mean, there are tools out there readily available already. I mean, I'm sure people are using Copilot or have heard of it and see what's going on there. So there's some nascent stuff which we're looking at. Do I see it making a huge difference over the course of the next 12 months? Probably not. But then that sort of things are changing all the time. Things are evolving all the time. We work quite closely with our data team. We're obviously an organization where we have to take IT, cyber, all of that security apparatus incredibly seriously, given the nature of what we do. So I'd be surprised if we're ever going to be at the forefront of all of this. But equally, we are working what's out there externally with in-house capabilities. And yeah, things are changing all the time. But and so over the course of the next couple of years, will it have some changes and impact on what we're doing? Probably. Is it going to make a huge difference? At the moment in time, I struggle to see. But let's see. These things can happen quickly.
And as we start to wrap up the conversation, what's the best piece of advice you can give to someone who's looking to move into investor relations from a different professional industry, such as accounting or sell side or buy side?
I think of it as two things. I think, one, you've got to be a bit geeky with the numbers. So this is a storytelling function, but you can only do it if you know what's happening with the numbers and you can see around corners. Because that you've got to be the eyes and ears of to the market for your CEO and CFO. You've got to be able to understand enough of what's going on with your own numbers internally to be able to then guide the market. And then equally, you've got to be able to get what they're saying and feed that back. So there is a technicality of it, which you need as a grounding. But you've also got to be able to then turn that into something which is compelling and interesting and wide-reaching and innovative. Can I do all of that? Not necessarily. I like to think I can. I'm sure my team will tell you that I can't. But then that's the second point. It's whatever job you do out there, it's all relationship-based, right? So you've got to have the right people around you to be able to deliver those outputs. So knowing where you want to go is super, super important. And then thinking about how you get there is also very important as well, and the people around you. But from my point of view, if you want to get into IR, do you love the numbers? Do you love the story? Can you do both of them? Even better. But I think having a love of the story is quite important, because you've got to keep telling it, keep telling it, keep telling it, and then evolving it and changing it. So I always used to think that you could get away with doing something that you weren't 100% interested in is a job. But actually, it's more than that. I think to do it well, you do have to have a little bit of passion about it to be able to tell it and to get people excited. And the one thing I'll always say to my CEO and CFO is, when we're on the road, we'll go and see an investor. That investor could well see another 4 or 5 CEOs or CFOs that day. What is it that investor will take away that evening and go home and see their husband, wife, partner, whatever, and say, I had the most amazing meeting today with the CEO of National Grid. He said, dot, 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 and it won't be that they've got a progressive dividend. As important as it is, that is not the one key takeaway. It is the stories. It is the good that we're doing. It is the generational change that we're enabling. And so that's the bit I would sort of leave people with. If you want to come and do this job, absolutely come and do it. It's the best place in a corporate. You get to see everything. You get to help shape the message. And it's a super, super exciting place. And you get to work with your CEO and CFO a lot. Pros and cons. But do it with passion. Do it because you're interested, and you'll get a lot more out of it.
I think your passion comes across really clearly. You really lit up when you were talking about the role. And I agree. I think you've got to relish the relationships that IR opens doors to. And the storytelling is quite a really consistent theme, actually, that comes across from speaking to lots of senior IR professionals. That's the one thing people enjoy. It's creative, yet technically, you know, challenging from a financial perspective as well. So the ability to combine that financial knowledge with your capability to turn that into a clear and compelling equity story is challenging but rewarding, I think, in equal regard. And it seems to be a really consistent theme from these conversations. I also think there's an element of which actually where you do have the luxury of having an IR team is that you can blend skill sets as well. You know, when I think about my team, some of our team are really strong when it comes to communication, particularly written communication and in reports. They're very passionate about that side of things. I personally much prefer the relationship side, the interaction with the buyer side and the sell side. We've got some team members that are really strong technically on modeling, and some who've got the buy side relationship. So if you have that luxury of building a team, you can actually blend different strengths, and then you've got a really optimal IR function that covers all aspects of the role. Lastly then, are there any questions that you would like to ask me?
So I guess we spent a lot of time talking about the importance of telling a good story and that resonating with investors, because that's ultimately why we're here. We want people to buy our shares. I like to think that Grid can be innovative and we try to do things in different ways. But equally, I always want to know what other people are doing and learn from the best. So what's going on out there? What are you hearing? What are you seeing? I know you'd have to name names, but what sort of storytelling or events or what do you think I could learn?
So it's an interesting contrast, because I see really innovative IR teams. And one of the, when we look at the awards in investor relations, we always look at innovation, and I'm super interested in what companies are doing. But the flip side of that is when I speak to, having just recorded a whole series of fund managers, they often don't have the capacity to engage with these different forms of communication. So I was unhappily surprised by how little video content was used, for example, whereas most of them, they value a capital markets day. They value different forms which give access to the broader range of management. That was a really clear and consistent theme. So I think these events are really important to run, but often how they engage with them is not on the day itself and in a transcript. So I think, you know, particularly if you've got a constrained budget, I would always bear in mind and almost have a conversation with your shareholders ahead of it, really investing in some very highly innovative but often expensive forms of communication. So I think it's really understanding what investors' needs are. The other interesting thing was, though, that actually you've talked about doing podcasts as well. And I'd never really thought about it, but investors say how often they scroll YouTube or they look for a management team doing a business leader podcast, for example, with a journalist, to actually just understand a little bit more when they're not in a management investor situation. And I think I've never really been aware or mindful of the broader things your CEO, your management team might be doing out there that gives investors real insight into what they're doing. So I think that's an interesting thing to bear in mind, is actually there's probably other touch points your management team have that can be helpful or can be relevant to investors. And I really liked you talking about podcasts, because I was thinking as you were talking about it, that maybe actually an IR interviewing your management team could be a really neat way, because it's accessible for investors. I know they engage with that kind of content. There's one of the funds, Norges Bank, do interviews with management teams, and multiple investors have referenced that to me as a really useful way to get to know the business team. So I think innovation is fantastic, and I love learning about all the different things IR teams are doing. But I'd always kind of call it back to how your investors, particularly your unique set of shareholders, will engage with that content, and always be mindful of prioritizing time, investment, energy, and budget before kind of cracking on with a really innovative, all singing or dancing IR program.
I agree. Interesting. But no, I think you got me thinking then about a podcast with our CEO, CFO. That could be very interesting, actually. What to think about?
I'm with sell-side analysts, so you get all just the management team answering questions, but actually, as an IR person, you know the questions that the investors ask. So you could almost bottom out a lot of those in a 30-minute recording that gives everyone access to the same information, and it's heavily curated, so there's no risk involved. It could be a really interesting format. Great. Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining me today.
Clara, thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
And thank you for joining Enquire, the Investor Relations podcast. Please look out for our next episode,